I'm gonna start saying that. Either they're gonna be mad or we don't live in our truth.
Exactly. The one thing I think we do that I think the respectability thing and the being accommodating is what allows this stuff to replicate, right? It's the moderation. It's the, like, let's not make the white people too upset. And if I'm reading their eyes and watching God, and we're also trying not to make the white people too upset. And we're like, and still today you say Black Lives Matter, and that makes the white people, like, making the white people upset is what we have to do, apparently. Because they're upset by equality. Right? Yeah, if they're upset by us being equal, that means they're just going to have to be mad. Because I think the one thing that all the social media and everything is exposing is how many people are leading fake lives. And so if morality, quote unquote, because what is morality? But if morality is a prerequisite for leadership, then we basically can't have any men leaders. So let's just keep it 100, right? Like,
hold up. You just got rid of like 48% of the population or something crazy.
Well, I'm just saying, like, you know, tell me which of your friends haven't done some dirt. You know, I think anyone who's been a trial lawyer, if you can try a case to a jury of people with the mental capacity of 12-year-olds, you can talk to your students. How can you not teach law students?
What's going on, world? This is my fourth take, and I'm not doing another take, so whatever comes out here will stay. So, welcome to the show. This is Read the Fine Print, the show. I am the host, Detravius Bethea. This episode is with Professor Carlos Chapman of William and Lee Law School. And yeah, it's a great conversation, man. The reason why this is my fourth and last take on this one, it's because really I'm trying to introduce this thing in the fine print and keep the intro in this box of telling you what the fine print of the episode was about. And I'm not going to do that anymore because my episodes are about so many things. So the underlying theme of this episode and why Professor Chapman, the reason I wanted her to come on, because I just think she's a great person. She's a great personality on social media. This is why actually our first time actually having a conversation. But I wanted her to talk about the path, the fine print of becoming a law professor. But that's all, as always, with all my episodes. The conversation is about much more than what the people come on to talk about. And that is by design. So I'm just going to stop trying to fit like these intros into like that. This is the fine print of the show and tell you what the fine print of the show. The fine print of the show is really just having messages and great life and career advice throughout the episode under the guise of we're digging into the fine print of whatever subject that we're talking about, that I'm talking about with the guests. So again, the underlying theme of this episode is the path to professorship, but we talk so much more about society, code switching, you know, Supreme Court. It was so many gems and jewels dropped in this. I guess a gem is a jewel. It was so much stuff dropped in this episode. I think you're going to enjoy it. And if you do, please like, rate, review, subscribe, share. And if you find it in your heart, think about becoming an advertiser on the show. Think about becoming a sponsor on the show. Think about donating the show, donating to the show, because this show takes time and money to produce. And you know, every little bit helps. Before I forget, I had a very, very, very special listenership number. I was going to reveal the number, but I'm not really going to do that really. Because at this point, I'm still not trying to play to the crowd. I'm just trying to be me and trying to be more authentic and trying to get better on the mic. So at this point in time, I mean, if you want to advertise, I'm definitely going to share them numbers with you. But just as a general thing, I'm not sharing the numbers until I feel comfortable. Oh, I may never share the numbers, because the numbers to me, I mean, they're important, but they're not important really, right? The most important thing to me is just to have great conversation. And if you are listening to this podcast, you are, you know, I guess you like the conversations that I'm having. So I'm gonna end it with that, and sit back and enjoy. Peace. State your name for the record.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm Carlos Chapman. I am an associate professor at Washington and Lee School of Law. I specialize in all forms of business and commercial law, in addition to teaching transactional skills. And what I like to write about is personhood and ethics. And what I mean by personhood is that, you know, I believe the status and who you are and how we classify things has an impact on how you engage with the free markets. It has an impact on how you engage with business and the economy. And so I have written about corporate personhood so far, but I've started there because I plan to venture into some comparative personhood, where I talk about, you know, what I consider to be a hierarchy, where, you know, corporations and white men are at the top.
Gotcha. You starting already. Go ahead.
So, you know, that's kind of the research agenda teaching package. I'm originally from Houston, Texas, went to Duke for law for undergrad and University of Texas for law school. So that's.
Got you. And before I get into it, because you starting off already on fire, I just want to give you your flowers while you can smell them. Like, I've been following you. I just told you before we started recording, since 2015, and you always got some fire. I think you do. You have a great, I don't know if anybody ever told you this, but you have a talent of educating while still being entertaining at the same time.
I try.
If that makes sense.
The students don't always get my jokes, because, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and they like, it falls flat. But on Facebook, you know, if I could have Facebook friends as my classroom.
When I used to teach at Rutgers, they didn't get it, because I grew up in the 80s and the 90s too. So I give it like a Tupac reference, and they just like,
they don't know who Tupac is. It's unfortunate. Yeah. I blame their parents though, because my niece knows who Tupac is. And you know, my sister and I made her listen to a bunch of Tupac and Biggie, and we were like, which do you choose? Like, why do I have to choose? And we're like, you have to pick one.
So who do you got? I think I know where you probably go from. You're from Texas.
I come down on Tupac, but I have started to appreciate Biggie more in my older age.
Okay.
Which is interesting. I think Biggie is more of a lyricist and is more skilled in his flow, whereas Tupac is more of a poet who also raps. And so both are good, but it's like, if you just want, like, I am more likely to play Biggie 20 years later, whereas Tupac is more speaking to the moment. So, you know, back then it's like, okay, this is a banger. And it's not that Tupac is not still a banger. It's just that, you know, you could play Biggie, I think, 20 years from now, and, you know, you can get a cook-off popping with Biggie in a way you can't with Tupac. Tupac is sometimes too deep. You can't just like throw some Tupac out at the cookout. First of all, how do you play the edited version? Like, you know, so Biggie, an edited version, you can play it at the cookout with your grandma there. Tupac, not so much.
And your resume is crazy. You was pretty humble with your introduction, but I'm going to let you be humble, because you being humble. But how did you get into the profession of law to begin with? Like, what did your parents do? whatever your path was, describe it to me.
So, you know, when I was little, you know, my grandmother always was like, you talk too much and you like to argue, so you need to be a lawyer. So that's when I was like, you know, 4 or 5 years old. And you know how Black grandmothers are, you have to do what they say.
Yeah.
So, you know, so, the seed was planted in my head that I always, you know, like to talk, like to argue, always had a smart mouth, could never fix my face. So it was like, go be a lawyer. But then also, I always liked to teach. Like, I used to play school when I was a kid. My sister would be like, you would be teacher and make us be in the classroom. And I would do that. So the idea of being a law professor or being a professor in general always appealed to me. And so, you know, growing up in Houston, was bused to school like, you know, most other Black kids who do G&T. Mm-hmm. And, just, you know, had parents that emphasized education. Mm-hmm. And grandparents too. Like, you know, we'd be at the library every week during the summer. Mm-hmm. We, you know, it was always about making good grades. You know, you hear immigrants tell their story about how they weren't allowed to make B's and didn't get money or prizes for making an A because A was expected. Like, that was my household. It's like, what? Like,
where are your parents from?
My parents are from Houston. I'm like a fourth generation Houstonian. My parents are from Houston. Okay. My grandparents are from Houston. Gotcha. Most of my great grandparents are from Houston. Okay. So I go way, way back with the Houston. So, you know, just having that instilled in me, and I have an aunt and an uncle who were professors at TSU, but not law professors, but professors at TSU when I was growing up. And then one of my dad's brother got a PhD at Michigan and taught for a while too. So it was just always a focus on education. Like, you are like, you know, my grandmother would be like, why should I go to your high school graduation? Like, everybody's supposed to graduate from high school. Like, why are we celebrating that?
Why are we celebrating that?
Right. Like, you know, get some degrees and we'll celebrate that, right?
Yeah.
So just that attitude of, you know, be excellent, be educated. You know, my grandmother, who didn't go to college, read the newspaper cover to cover every day.
Oh, wow.
My mother's mother, every single day. And like, you know, that was like a household thing when I was growing up, where sit down and pass sections of the newspaper. So everybody is reading the newspaper. And so just those kinds of things where it's like, oh no, you're not going to be out here being mediocre. It's a big difference. Then, you know, it's interesting, when I was an undergrad, I had a serious kind of moment where I thought I was just going to go get a PhD straight out and not go to law school at all. But the law kept calling me. And then I practiced law way longer than I expected. I practiced 11 years.
Okay.
And some of that is the money, right? Uh-huh. Like, some of that is, you know, trying to pay some bills, trying to save some money, working at big law. It's, you know, it's definitely golden handcuffs, but it's also just
being, it's still golden though. It's still golden.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still gold.
I will tell you, like, I still don't make what I made when I was 30. Like, I don't know that I will ever again make the kind of money I made when I was at big law, getting those where you just get like a $20,000 check in the mail at the end of the year. Like, here's 20 grand. It's like, I miss those days. But that's a lifestyle that's hard to give up. Mm-hmm. So I honestly think it's why we don't have more Black law professors, because if you didn't grow up with intergenerational wealth, which we didn't, and you are making, you know, even if you have a private practice, you kind of get to a point as a lawyer where you can be guaranteed $200K a year, you know, just from running your own cases or having a plaintiff's case that lands, or, you know, even just doing criminal defense work, you can get that stream of income running. And to step away from that and go be a VAP, where, you know, some VAPs, visiting assistant professorships and fellowships and things like that, that are necessary to be professors, some of those pay like 35 or 40 grand a year.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, how are you gonna be grown making $40,000? You know, so the fact that we've added these additional barriers to entry, where you don't just need a law degree anymore to be a law professor, means that anybody that doesn't have intergenerational wealth or a bunch of money saved, or isn't okay being poor for a while, is probably not going to transition to do it. Have intergenerational wealth or savings or the willingness to just be poor for a while, you're not going to go do it.
Yeah. This is what I see for you. I don't know if somebody ever told you this or not. You're going to make way more money that you did and at the Big Law. And this is why I see that for you. Like I said, I've been following you for 5 years. Your personality. You have a personality for like some type of television type something. So I don't know if you've been called for that, anything, or, you know.
No, people tell me that all the time. But it's interesting because I only like to talk to people when I want to talk to people.
That could be a problem for the check.
It's hard. Yeah. And, you know, one of my friends always says it's hard to be smart and funny all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you kind of notice it with the people who are on TV, like the law professors are on TV all the time.
Yeah.
It's not that they're not, like, it is hard to be smart, funny, on point every single day. And like you start to see it where it's like,
Yeah. See, I don't think you should do it every day. I think you should do like pop in here and there as one of the quote unquote talking heads. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I started reading a couple of the things you sent me, and I don't know how much you could talk about it because it's not published yet.
Well, I can talk about them.
Okay. So your writing style, right, is a gold mine for, like, for the lack of a better term, and people are going to get mad at me in the comments, for bougie black folks, right? Like, it's smart, intelligent, and like I said, it's educational at the same time. So I think there is a market, because I think we are, we're like, you know, 40 plus now, 30, late 30s, 40s, like that whole generation that came up off of Tupac, Biggie, that are smart, but they don't have any other outlets. I think that's going to be your lane. But, and if that's your lane, you need to give me some 15% because I told you.
We'll see. If you want to write up some contracts and be a manager, we can discuss.
Yeah, we can discuss it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because like I said, you have the personality for it. Yeah, I think even with the podcasting thing, right? So I said, once it starts becoming like a job, I'm going to stop because I don't really want another job. So I get the sense the whole, trying to be funny. I don't know if you need to do that though nowadays.
You know what though? It doesn't feel like a job. So like, you know, what is so funny about, I post on Facebook and Twitter when I'm walking my dog.
Gotcha.
That's when I post. And so people are like, how are you on social media all the time? And I was like, well, my dog needs like 3 walks a day. So, you know, I'm walking my dog around the neighborhood and posting. And so, you know, I've had people ask me, how do you plan your posts? Or how do you make your posts fit what you're writing about? Or how do you do this? And I'm like, I just am reading newspaper articles as I'm walking my dog and saying what I think off the top of my head, which people who know me in person get it, because I always say what's on the top of my head. As I said, like, I was the kid who always got in trouble for talking too much.
Yeah.
The wrong thing in the wrong place. Like, I never learned how to like be appropriate. So I just couldn't get it together.
Yeah.
And my parents would be like, we don't know what to do with that one. So, you know, it's just who I've always been. And I always have an opinion about everything. I might not be right, but I have an opinion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it helps. And it helps to just read a lot, honestly. Like, you know, you're like, what are you reading? And I was like, it's hard for me to pin down what exactly I am reading. Mm. You know, like I read Wall Street Journal almost every day, at least the headlines. Like I'm reading CNN, read Washington Post sometimes, then, you know, reading in my scholarship area. So reading articles about things that nobody cares about except me. But then like I'll read like behavioral psychology and economics and, you know, just stuff that even law professors aren't reading. And so I get the influence of reading interdisciplinary stuff.
Uh-huh.
But then I'm also reading like YBF and BOSIP and Root. And I need to know what Cardi B and them are doing. Like, I have to know, because Offset bought her a car for her birthday. That was important information.
That's so important information.
It really is. So, you know, I think, you know, too, like, you know, people will say bougie black people, like I definitely behave like a bougie black person, but I always say like I have my hood stain.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm never gonna stop, you know, reading, you know, following the pop culture and keeping up with all the cousins, including the cousin you're not supposed to claim. Wow. And, you know, all of that, like, that's just how I was raised. You know, I was raised proud and black while also being intelligent. Like, not code switch, to not, like, you know, stand in who you are and to, you know, be you no matter what is the first thing. And, you know, the other thing I do is, you know, I believe in saying what I think, because, you know, if you're silent, you'll be oppressed. Right.
You just dropped a lot of things just now. So you say you were taught not to code switch. Explain that, because I think that's maybe unique. Well, not unique. Obviously, other people doing it, but that's not common.
I don't necessarily have an accent, although when I move other places, they tell me I do. But, I think that my parents were always like, be who you are. And so I generally talk like this all the time.
Okay.
You know, Stephanie, our mutual friend, is like, I sound like a Valley girl. I'm not code switching. This is just how I always talk. And my niece sounds like this and my sister sounds like this. But, you know, it's just like you can't maintain constant code switching. So like, I'm not going to use the same words that I would use in a conversation with a Black person, but I don't change my voice.
Gotcha.
For white people. Cause I just think also white people need to get used to living with Black people as they are. We have to stop wearing masks for white people. We have to stop putting on respectability and being a certain kind of Black person for white people, because that means we're serving as gatekeepers. Mm. You know, we won't hire the person with a Southern accent, or we won't hire the person who drops Ebonics or pop culture. We're doing the master's work for them. Mm-hmm. And why are we doing that?
Why are we doing that? That is a great question. That this might be a sound bite. Why are we doing that?
Do we love ourselves?
Yeah, I must admit though, I did struggle. Like I went through I say this on the podcast all the time. I know people that listen, I'm like, dang, he keep talking about the same story. I did struggle with the whole code switching for like a year. And then one day I just woke up one day, because I was subconscious about my voice and how I sound and my accent and, you know, double negatives and all that other good stuff. And I was just like, you know what? So I thought my interview voice needed to be a couple octaves higher.
Yeah, why?
And I was just like, you know what? Why am I doing this? Like, so I'm subconscious about my voice and the interview voice. So it's only gonna be one and the other. So I'm glad I got rid of that like early on, like my early 20s. And I was just like, this is just who I am. If they like it, they like it. They don't, they don't.
It's also so many other things to think about. Like, I'm too busy thinking about being oppressed.
Gotcha.
To think about my voice.
Exactly. And I think people, and one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the podcast, because I think people need to hear that more often. It's Black people, like it's cool. I think because of COVID and the political climate that we are in now, I think it seems like it's more acceptable, for lack of a better term, now than it was even last year at this time. But yeah, we need to hear those type of messaging, like you are enough, like your name is enough. Like I used to juggle with my name, Detravius. Like, should I shorten it? Should I call myself David? Like those type of things. Is like, nah. Like, mm-mm. One, why would you want to be in that situation? Why would you want to work with somebody or be around people that just not accepting you for who you are?
Right, right. I'm always like, well, you're gonna pronounce it right. You're gonna spell it right.
Exactly. I went through the same thing. We have a lot of similarities. I want to talk about all the similarities, like the GNT. I saw you was an Africana study. You was your major or minor?
Major in Africana studies. Yeah.
Yeah. I was a major in Africana studies too at Rutgers.
I think that helps too. You know, reading all the Black literature that you didn't get to read.
Exactly.
Growing up, and I read a lot of Black literature growing up because my parents, you know, were woke in that way, but even they weren't showing me everything.
Yeah,
right. Like I wasn't reading like Elaine Locke and all of that, So just reading, you know, reading The Full Breath and just understanding how there has been Black excellence in writing from Du Bois forward and even.
Exactly.
Yeah. And even earlier. And so the idea that Black people aren't scholars and that Black people aren't intellects, when it's like, look at this whole canon that could be a major and I still didn't even read everything.
Yeah, we still didn't read it. So my story is I was an African studies major. Actually, I was an African. Yeah. And then I did an honors research project, and I had to basically pick one. My senior year, because it was worth 12 credits, mm-hmm. and it basically was like 100 page paper. It was called the Henry Rutgers Scholars Program, which is no longer exists, but that's another story. And Yes, like then when I taught at Rutgers for 6 years after that, I didn't teach at the law school, but I taught in the African Studies department. Like you said, it is so much work out there, and so much research, and so much critical thinking, writing. It's like if you're not exposed to it, you wouldn't necessarily know that it exists, because we're not, you know, we live in a white supremacist world. Like we're not supposed to know, I guess.
Right. Well, us not knowing our history and our excellence is the biggest part of white supremacy, right?
Absolutely.
Thinking that, you know, we need to read Chaucer and not Morrison.
Yeah,
white supremacy. When it's like, why do I need to read this Chaucer? Have you read this? Have you seen what Toni Morrison did on the stage?
Yeah, it's funny because it's funny that you dropped Toni Morrison, because I'm actually starting to reread. So I've read every book that she's written, and I'm starting to reread them. The last three, I think I missed.
I missed the last few before she passed. Everything that she wrote up until I was in school, I have read. Yeah. I think I read one past that. But I want to do the same thing. I want to reread it because it's just gems. Like
it's gems. When you reread it, and I just know like me at 40 plus versus me being 20, some of that stuff just went over my head. Like when I first read it, and like she's talking through, it's so many like gems and lessons and all this other good stuff within people like us. He's talking about people that look and sound like us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think the last one I read was like,
I was rereading Their Eyes Are Watching God.
Eyes Are Watching God. Yeah.
And I started analyzing it through a business law lens, which was just, I was like, oh my God, I could be citing this. Like, you know, what she says about Black women and what she says about, I was like, first of all, let's look at the fact that what she wrote about Janie is true today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Like Hurston writing in the 20s.
Yeah.
It is true 100 years later about Black entrepreneurship, about everything about the Black male-female dynamic. Like, how is that still true today?
How is that still true today? So one of the book that I just recently gave away this book to not my barber, but a guy that worked in my barber shop not too long ago. It was The Miseducation of Negro. I used to read that like every few months, actually, like just read like pages of it, not like the whole book cover to cover. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, it used to get me mad because I'm like, the same shit is still going on. Right. 70 plus years later, the same, almost, well, it's like 80 years now, 90 years, like it's still going on. And I'm just like, man, like it used to get me upset, but it also used to motivate me. So like I have to be the change people. So we are not having, at least my little butterfly effect can affect the world somehow. So somebody, someplace is not having those same conversations. Like, oh man, we doing the same thing over and over again. But that's my book. Yeah.
The one thing I think we do that, I think the respectability thing and the being accommodating is what allows this stuff to replicate, right? It's the moderation. It's the, like, let's not make the white people too upset. And if I'm reading Their Eyes Are Watching God, and we're also trying not to make the white people too upset. And we're like, and still today you say Black Lives Matter, and that makes the white people, like making the white people upset is what we have to do, apparently. Because they're upset by equality. Right? Yep. If they're upset by us being equal, that means they're just going to have to be mad.
That is what it is, right?
Yeah.
Either they be mad or we don't live in our truth.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start saying that. Either they're going to be mad or we don't live in our truth.
Exactly.
And both of them can't exist at the same time.
Well, either they're mad or we're not even persons, right? That's what I write about. Like, we are still 3/5 because, you know, white comfort is us being 3/5. That's what white comfort is.
Yeah. So for the people that don't follow you, right? Like you're always on fire when it comes to the so I follow you more. I just recently started following you on Twitter because Twitter's not really my thing. Although I think I need to be over there more because Facebook gets too much sometimes. Mm-hmm. Your Facebook posts. What what are you seeing? Because you've been on fire for like the last 2 months with your posts. You've been what's going on? What shifted? Or you all, like I said, you're always on fire, but more recently it's been like I don't know, like on some next level you got the glow, Bruce Leroy type show.
Not a show enough moment. Yeah. So I think multiple things are happening. One, I teach at Washington and Lee, and we're having this name change debate on our campus. And I've sat in a lot of meetings where white people have tried to tell me how good Robert E. Lee is.
Damn, that's got to be crazy.
And I was like, you know what? Apparently, I need to start telling people that Robert E. Lee ain't shit. Like, apparently, I need to tell people that Robert E. Lee would tar and feather black people and like land lynch. Like, how do I? And then just the idea that it was like, wait, I have to tell people that Robert E. Lee is a horrible person in 2020. To the point that our university is debating whether we should keep the name because of the good that Robert E. Lee did in the world. And I'm just like.
So I didn't know, even know what, that's where the Lee came from.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
President of the university after the Civil War. So he was there until he died. His body is buried on our campus.
Wow.
Lee House is where the president of the university lives. So the house he lived in, he was president, is where the president of the university lives to this day. And so there's a whole chapel. His body is in the chapel. It's called Lee Chapel. There's no Jesus in the chapel, though.
But it's Lee. Robert E. Lee is in it.
It's Robert E. Lee. It's a recumbent. They call it the recumbent Lee statue. Mm. That is at where Jesus would be in a church. That's in the chapel. And that's what's on our campus. And, you know, so like that culture. And then, you know, I'm involved a lot with mentoring Black women, especially, but, you know, anybody essentially who wants to get into law teaching. Okay. And the COVID hiring season and the foolishness, like the fact that, you know, we've got COVID plus the normal racism that goes into the hiring process has just had me on, you know, 12 as far as like.
I knew it was something.
Like kind of the it's the culmination of the time too. And it's the, you know, if you look at what's happening with COVID and how white people are so comfortable acting like the world is normal because they're not dying. They are not, like, I could go to a Zoom or YouTube funeral probably every week if I fully dialed in to all the people I know in various Black communities in this country, right? Like if you know people in Detroit, if you know people in Houston, if you know people in New York, if you know people in major Black metropolitan areas and you paid attention, you could pop in at somebody's aunt, grandmother, cousin, you know, church member, deacon. Well, you could pop in on a Zoom funeral probably every single week as a Black person. But then white people are like, I don't know anybody who's had it, or I don't know anybody who's died. And so it's just highlighting the extreme racial disparity. In that, like, of course they can go, you know, they want to be in the office and of course they want to, you know, go be normal and as normal as possible. And it's like, well, your people aren't dropping dead the way ours are. Combined with just the acknowledgement now that we're all sitting at home and can pay attention. I won't even say it's a rise in police violence. It's that we now pay attention to it.
Remember, we're recording it. Everybody's a reporter now. Back in the day, you know, them camera phones. I mean, I have my issues with the smartphone, but, you know, with everything, it's pros and cons to it. Everybody has a camera now, you know, and it's cheap.
Well, here's what bothers me about that. If you're you are an Africana studies major, you've been in the game talking about this stuff for 20 years.
Yep. So over 20 years.
20 years, right? So what makes me go up on 12 about it, right, is that the stuff that white people are asking me about now and like need me to tell them right now, it's like, I told you that 5 years ago, though, or I told you that 20 years ago, or we had this discussion in the dorm when I was an undergrad and you tried to gaslight and say racism wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
So it just makes me a little, you know, I'm less tolerant and I'm not suffering fools like I used to. Gotcha. Right. Because if you just now figured out life is bad for Black people, I don't even know what to say to you.
Yeah, I have when I remember one time, your story, just how long I've been in the game with this Africana studies stuff, not beyond just being Black, like being like, all right, I'm studying this thing. I remember, like, I don't know if it was my freshman or sophomore year at Rutgers. So I'm like, we in a class, and this is a young white woman. This was a night class. So I had to work my way through school. So I was night class whenever I could fit it in with my work schedule, right? So this is at night. So I'm assuming she was just taking it the fulfill a requirement, because you know we have the requirements for your majors and all that, right? So Camden, New Jersey had came up somehow, and it was like some type of law that would, but they were taking away the public transportation to the local, well, it's not local, but the next mall, I would say, right? And so she had like this, I knew we wasn't vibing, because she had like a woman for Trump. I mean, not a woman for, damn, Trump Bush is on my mind. A woman for Bush. Yeah, woman for Bush.
Yeah.
Woman for Bush button, right? And then one day, I mean, she was cool for the most part, just to see how oblivious people are, though. So one time, so she was like, so they was taking a bus route. Something was going on with the public transportation to a spot where jobs are that people from Camden was working at. And you know, we were talking about it in class, and she just said, like, and she didn't understand why it was a big deal. She said, if they don't want to live in the Camden, why don't they just move? I mean, it's funny now, but you wasn't there, so it's not really funny to you. But it was like one of those things, like, if people would, so everybody just looked at it like, so she's like the only white girl in the class. Everybody just looked at it like, if they could move, don't you think they would move? But it's just like, it was just that simple in her head. Like, if they don't want to live there or they can't get to their jobs, why don't they just move? And she was dead serious.
Well, and yeah, it's because they have intergenerational wealth. And yeah, they can live anywhere. We can't live everywhere. We still can't live everywhere.
You can't even live everywhere if you got the proper money, depending on like these laws that they got on the books and the titles and all that. Or those still illegal. It's supposed to be illegal, but you know that.
But people ask for a bigger down payment, or people will, like, you know, people will find a way to discriminate against you, no matter how much money you have, no matter what, you know, that, you know, so she just doesn't get it, because life is just open to her. She has freedom. She has full personhood. We don't, right? We don't. Yeah. So we can't be it. We have to be where we're allowed to be.
Yeah, but it was, I had never heard someone ask that question that simply, but it was so like, wow, you really don't know until that point. Like, although, like, so I grew up living in the hood, and then I moved to the suburbs and when I was in the eighth grade. And they used to ask me, like, dumb questions, like, you know, can you play basketball? Which, low-key, that's racist, too.
It's so racist. It's so racist. I'm an athletic black person in America. It's so hard to go to school with white people and not be athletic as a black person. Because everybody, you know, once you get to a new white school and they want to, like, pick you first for the team, and it's like, you're real disappointed.
We real disappointed.
Like, that's a stereotype that is just not true for all of us. Not
true for all of us.
Sorry, it's not. Yeah, it's like, I could barely run without tripping over my own feet. Like, it was.
So we had a similar struggle. I said we got a lot in common, because I was in the GNT, the gifted and talented too. So when I moved to the suburbs, they tried to take me out of the program. So I was the eighth grade. So I went through 5K through 8 schools, always in gifted and talented. And my mom, one of the things we share in common, like, so I'm the first college graduate that's actually a descendant of my maternal grandmother, not my paternal grandmother though. So, but that's like, we're talking like 30 plus people though, right? Mm-hmm, so, my mom used to always make me feel like getting a C was just the worst thing in the world. Like, so she'd just be like, you got a C? You know, that's average, right? you want to be average. And like, so from like, I don't know, like the first time I remember bringing home a C after that speech, I don't think I ever brought home a C on my report card until like the eighth grade, right? And she put me on punishment, man, for like the summer.
Yeah. You know, I feel like if I came home with like a D, I might not be here right now.
I couldn't. D, I wouldn't even try. Like, I don't even know.
I wouldn't go home. I'd see that report card and be like, I got to run away.
Yeah, I would. Mm-mm. Yeah, D. That's crazy. Like, I don't even know like what that life would have been like. But my mother put me on punishment for getting a C on my report card one year for the summer.
On punishment and in summer school. Because I feel like that's some stuff. My mom would be like, "So you're remedial now? Okay, yeah. So you need to go to summer school and you need to, you know."
So I was like the only. So when I moved to the schools I went to before the suburbs was they predominantly black and Puerto Rican, Spanish. I don't know what the politically correct term nowadays, But so when I moved, it was like culture shock. So I'm the only black person. Well, it was two. I was the only black male in like the gifted and talented, and it was this black girl. Her name was Latoya, and we both had super black names, Latoya. And the light bulb moment that happened. So like that's when I really started messing up in school. I did horrible in high school, but it was like the light bulb moment happened for me. And just and then like I was getting in trouble a lot. I think a lot of it now when I think about it, it was like a lot of it was racial driven because I was really the only, they was black people there, but I was really the only person that was really, really from the hood. It was racism and classism that was there. And I just didn't think they, I don't think they was intentionally racist, but it's the unintentional, right? That's really the ones that really kills us, right? Because it's like, I just don't think they knew how to handle my energy, everything. Like if I bang on the desk, that's the problem, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it happens now with, you know, black boys and girls being sent to the principal's office and having a record because they, the truth is black kids are doing the same thing white kids are doing in school.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just like you have a stereotype where you expect black people to sit down and be quiet. And, you know, if the black kid isn't sitting down and being quiet, they need to go to the principal's office.
Yep.
But the hard thing about those microaggressions and that like silent racism is you have to prove it.
Prove it. Yeah.
And then people want to gaslight you and say it's not racist. Well, you make everything about race, or this isn't, I'm not racist. I didn't intend it that way. Yeah. So I've just started people, what I've started saying to white people is I don't say that is racist. I will say, this is how I interpret what you said.
Okay.
This is what I heard. Like you said that, and this is what I heard, and this is what most black people hear. So if you don't want black people to hear you that way, like if you really care, right? Like, are you okay?
That's the one thing, if they really care, right?
Yeah. Well, are you okay with black people hearing you in this way?
Okay.
Well, then maybe you should listen to me and like do what I'm telling you to do. If you're fine with knowing that, I was like, if you are fine knowing that every black person who hears you thinks you're racist because of what you just said, keep doing it. But if not, maybe listen to what I'm saying and like try to change your thinking. So, and I've started being more self-centered, right? So instead of saying globally, this is racist, you know, I will say perception is reality and my opinion matters. And my opinion, whether it's correct or not, is X. Are you okay with me thinking this about you? Because this is what I think about you based on what you said or on what you did.
I'm gonna change my approach. I'm gonna just start using your approach. I think that approach may be way more effective because I've been calling people racist for years.
Me too. It's like my second job.
Yeah, yeah. And their knee-jerk reaction is this I'm not racist. And then they go into all the reasons why they're not racist. And I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna incorporate what you just how you approach it, but always out. Another thing that I do do is that I tell them that, you know, being racist is not necessarily like exclusive to you having a hood on and burning crosses and people lawns. Do you know that, right? It's like little things that you do and say every day, that the same thing with sexism. Like the little things that you do every day that is racist and sexist that we just don't think about because nobody's questioning. Like we're living the status quo. We're living in the moment. Nobody's is asking us like, why did you say that? Or you know, that's sexist, right? You know, that's racist. But what I realized is people are comfortable with having the sexism conversation, the racism conversation. Nobody wants to admit that they're racist.
Well, because they think you're calling them a bad person or you're calling them evil. And I'm like, I do feel like you're a little evil. Which is why you might want to change. Like, I know you think when I say you're racist, that means I think you're evil. Yeah. A little bit. Yeah. So that's why you need to understand that if you say something and I hear it and take it as racism, that is me being like, well, that's the white devil over there. Right. Yeah. Like, and some of that is survival. I've been explaining that to white people too. Like, I have to make quick value judgments about every white stranger I meet. And so if you do little microaggressive things that tell me you are racist, I don't get where I am in life if I don't make these value judgments and put white people in categories. So do you want to be in the category of white people I don't trust and white people I don't talk to and white people who are, you know, maybe I can use you as a pawn, but we're never going to be friends. Or do you want to be in the white people category of who I'm cool with? Because the white people I'm cool with don't say racist shit, right? It's like Black people make these quick snap decisions every day from the grocery store. You could be at the gas station and you got to size somebody up and look at their car and their clothes and their behavior and decide, is this somebody who's going to like try to lynch me or are they cool? And we do that constantly. We judge white people constantly and we observe white people constantly. So we know white people better than they know themselves.
I always say that too. They be like, no, you don't.
Oh, yes, we do. Because we notice all their micro behaviors.
Yeah.
I think it's also why Black people make such good lawyers, especially such good litigators.
Yeah.
Because we've been judging people and making value decisions our entire life. That's how you get to be alive, mm-hmm. right? To decide whether you walk down that street or this street, decide whether you go to that neighborhood or this neighborhood, to decide, you know, is it time to roll up out the party or not? Like, those kind of judgments that we have to make to live.
That's real right there. A lot of people that's not Black are not going to get that. Like, yo, is it time to roll out the party? It's time to go.
Like, let's go. Like, where's everybody? Like,
yeah, when you, it's time to go. We used to have like a hand signal.
Like to see murder and so-and-so got his gun out. Like, everybody out. Drop your drink. Let's go.
Let's go. So let's get into the fine print of law professors are, it's professorship and it's adjuncts and all that too, right?
Yeah, so that's a good way to start, the fine print of it. So so to be a tenure track Black professor, I think it's only 2% of all professors total.
Damn.
Are tenure Black and tenure track. So a lot of the folks you see on a campus who are called professor or dean, who are Black, like some of these deans of diversity and inclusion, these like, you know, folks who are over in student affairs, these folks who are over in admissions who have a dean title, or a lot of these professors of the practice, adjuncts, et cetera, those people are on year-to-year contracts and they don't have job security.
Adjunct, yeah, at Rutgers, we was on class. Yeah, it was year-to-year, semester-to-semester, actually.
Yeah. So zero job security, but they're using you to get their numbers up, right? I'm sure they counted you, mm-hmm. right? And So that's the thing. So people don't know the difference. So I meet so many people who are like, oh, well, I'm adjuncting. I'm a professor. And I was like, but they don't think you're a professor. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I'm the dean of this. And it's like, are you a dean who's a professor? Or are you a dean who, you know, just has a degree and they hired because they need to have some diversity? So that's the first barrier, is understanding what it takes to get there. That's the real fine print, right? Okay. And so the truth is, to be a law professor, all you need is a law degree and to write. that's the entry. Write law review articles, not not books, not other things. Write law review articles, have a law degree. Express some interest and reach out and get some mentors. The things that Black people don't have are the references that the white candidates have, mm-hmm. because we don't have the relationships with the professors. Mm-hmm. We don't have any Black professors. If 2% of all tenure track professors are Black, that means if you had a Black professor in college, it was probably an adjunct, which means that person can't write you a letter of rec. Which means if that's the only professor you bonded with in college, you don't have anyone to write you a letter of rec. Or if you had no Black professors in law school, so you bonded with no one, you don't have anyone to write you a letter of recommendation. So you need letters of recommendations and references, and people like it when it's other people in the academy. The other thing that we don't do is we don't take those low-paying jobs. We graduate and it's like, where's the money? And so if I had it to do over again, I'd probably do a federal clerkship. But at the time, Sallie Mae was talking to me and I'm like, am I going to pass up making, what was it? 125, 160. Am I going to pass up making more money than my parents combined to like get a clerkship? Or am I going to go stack this paper and pay some bills? Right. And so it's those, you know, the lack of intergenerational wealth then means that when I started teaching, I was not as good of a candidate, because I didn't have a clerkship. I didn't really know professors at my law school because I went to UT. I couldn't stand them. Most of them are racist. So, you know, didn't even like enough of my professors to have references. You know, I could write. I had writing. I had papers. But I didn't have the like soft factor. So I started in a VAP, which is a visiting assistant professor.
Okay.
It was a 2-year program where I taught one class a semester, had time to write, built out my teaching package, had time to go to conferences and build the relationships so I could look like a good candidate. But we start way, way back to get into any form of academia. Even things like folks go get the PhD at University of Phoenix. You are not going to be a professor when you go get the PhD at Phoenix. It's not going to happen. It's not. Maybe community college.
What about Shaq? Don't Shaq got a degree from University of Phoenix? He not official.
Shaq just voted for the first time. So what does that tell you? So, you know, I love him. Bless his heart. But that's not the model you should be following.
My bad. I didn't mean to cut you off. I think he got a degree from University of Phoenix, but go ahead.
Yeah. But I mean, so it's things like that where it's like, oh, well, to be a professor, I need a PhD. I'm going to just do this thing. It's like, no, because you're going to get a job by the letters of rec and by the connections. And you're not making any connections sitting at your house at Phoenix. And so even if it's a decent degree, right, it's the fact that you are not on the campus getting the hookups. You're not getting to present at the conferences. You're not doing all the things that need to be done. So we just don't have the information that it takes to become professors. Now, some people will say you need to go to a top 20 law school, or you need to go here, you need to go there. I don't subscribe to that because, again, as I've told you, I don't believe Black people should be acting as gatekeepers and doing the master's work. So if somebody has a law degree and they have written a paper or are working on some scholarship and they call me and say they want to be a law professor, you know, I don't say you can't be a law professor. I will say, let's sit down and think about what the timeline is to get you there. Like, maybe you need to take a fellowship. Maybe you need to take a VAP. Maybe you need to adjunct somewhere. Maybe you need to start speaking at some conferences and getting to know some people. You know, everybody's path is going to be different. But I never tell somebody they can't be a professor, because I have met white male professors of various ages. I've met white male professors who've been teaching longer than I've been alive. And I guarantee you, we can do it. When I see what they do in the classroom, you know, I think anyone who's been a trial lawyer, if you can try a case to a jury of people with the mental capacity of 12-year-olds, you can talk to your school. How can you not teach law students?
See, you on fire.
But that was my argument when I went into teaching. When they're like, what can you teach? I was like, anything. Because I've tried cases. Do you know what jurors look like? If I can teach the law to jurors, I think I can teach it to these people that have undergraduate degrees. I think I can do it.
Got you. When I re-listen to this, it's like, that's going to be a great, I'm going to steal that and start using. I'm going to give you credit and send you.
That's fine. Just quote me. As long as you quote me, I'm cool with it. I'm cool with it.
Yeah, I'm going to quote you and send you your residuals and all that if I get it.
Right. Or make a meme out of it. I don't care. Whatever. Yeah. I mean,
I'm definitely making memes out of it.
I've got memes on Instagram from my tweets. And so I have my RAs. I love my, so I have my RAs keep me cool. I always try to have RAs of color, or, you know, at least not all, but, you know, as many as possible. And so one of my RAs just monitors my Instagram for me.
Got you.
And like monitors when I get, because I don't understand how to use Instagram, to be honest, not effectively. So she'll be like, Professor Chapman, your tweet is a meme. And I'm like, huh? Yeah. Here's the screenshots. And I'm like, thank you, because, you know, I'm the old lady over here who's not learning any technology. Or it'll be like, you know, it ended up on Reddit, or it ended up on this, or it ended up on, what's the other thing they use? Snapchat. I was like, I don't even have Snapchat. And they're like, oh, I just got your tweet on Snapchat. And I'm like, that's cool.
I don't understand Snapchat. I don't. The only things I could think of that Snapchat is useful for is like illegal things, and I'm trying not to do illegal things.
Well, and I just believe there's always a record, so it's like, I don't believe.
Yeah, it never disappears. Yeah.
I don't believe in Snapchat as a theory, and so these poor kids out here, you know, being foolish on Snapchat, thinking it won't come up when they run for Congress in 10 years.
Yeah, nothing. Once you put it out there, it's somewhere. Just because it's like, it's not on your little screen, it's somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have Snap. Oh, I did it, but I took it off because I was like, I don't know what it is useful for outside of hood rat things. And
I do, my friends and I do our hood rat things in the tech chain. So I feel like I need to have a friend erase my phone.
Gotcha.
It happens to me because of the foolishness.
You need to have that.
Foolishness we text and DM.
Yeah. It's out of control. I mean, I think everybody's the same thing is everybody's below a certain age is out of control though. It's just that we're all putting up these fronts on social media that we're not up to the same things, but everybody's thing looks crazy.
I want to vote for somebody who is like, yes, I'm a total freak. Here's my DMs. I'm in the strip club every week.
Yeah.
My wife and I have an open relationship. Like, I want to vote for a real person. That's what I want. Because I think the one thing that all the social media and everything is exposing is how many people are leading fake lives. And so if morality, quote unquote, because what is morality? But if morality is a prerequisite for leadership, then we basically can't have any men leaders. So let's just keep it 100, right? Like,
hold up. You just got rid of like 48% of the population or something crazy.
Well, I'm just like, tell me which of your friends haven't done some dirt in college, right? Like, who is like, you're either lying or is something wrong with you? Like, are you some sort of sociopath?
Let me be clear. I think everybody is dirty, quote unquote, for lack of a better term. So I don't know if I'm a good person. Like, that's just, I don't know if I'm one of those half empty, half full people. I don't know where I fall on that, but I think everybody is basically ain't shit until we got to be shit, really.
Exactly. And so, if you're acting like you always been shit since you was like 12, we know that's not the truth.
That's not the truth.
That's not the truth. So we just need to stop. Like, literally, we disqualify everybody except like priests and nuns.
Yeah. I think everybody, man. And like I said, I don't know if what would people label me. I just try to be real. Like, everybody's doing something wrong or have done something wrong. It's just
right.
I don't know how you escape this life without at least being ain't shit.
Right. I think some people decide they want to be politicians or leaders or whatever early on, and so they're good at covering up their dirt.
Yeah, that might be
because they've been doing the dirt and covering up since they were since they were in middle school. Yeah. But I'm like, that's actually worse. I kind of want it to be easy for you to get caught, because then I don't think you're a sociopath. Like, if you've been Kavanaugh-ing it, saving your journals and writing different stuff in your journal at night. Then what actually happened on the chance that you actually are at a confirmation hearing, you're like, here's my diary from 1982. That's weird as hell. Like, it's nothing wrong with you.
Yeah, you just threw a shot at somebody, but I don't know if people want that or not, but
I mean, I have no problem throwing a shot at Kavanaugh, right? Because all of it is. Because it's like, even if you're not a rapist or you're not engaged in a sexual assault, I'm disturbed that you have your journal from 1982.
Yeah, I thought I was the only one
like that. Like,
I guess obviously I wasn't the only one, but I was just like, I thought the whole process was weird, but that was definitely weird. Like, his response to the process, like, yo, bro, why do you have like this detailed calendar from, like you said, 1980? Like, what's wrong with you? Like, why? And you have it readily available.
Right. So you knew what you were doing back then was an issue. So you created a false record, is how I take it.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't even think about that. See, that's why you're smart. That's why you're smarter than me. Like, it's a false record. I thought he was just keeping a record. I don't know what I thought.
I think he's keeping a record, but he's keeping a record that looks clean, right? It's like, I'm not gonna write my dirt in my diary.
That's true.
I'm holding these calendars because I know I'm out here doing dirt, and someday I want to be president, or someday I want to be on the court. So here I am in high school doing dirt and making a false record. It's like, you're like the Supreme Court equivalent of Dexter over here. Like, what is happening? Like, can we not talk about the psychosis that goes with that? Yeah. Like,
that's a very great point. Like I said, you've been on fire. I didn't think, but yeah, people are not writing down their dirt like that. You're right. So I guess if people were, I guess if you're keeping a journal, you're probably for the most part keeping, but you're definitely keeping about of what you want to remember and your perception of things that happen.
Like, I don't think I ever wrote, jumped in somebody's car and went to A&T homecoming in my day planner. Right? In college, like ran into some random dudes on the quad and decided I wanted to roll to A&T's homecoming. That's not in my day planner.
Right?
So yeah. Like to pull out your day planner, like why would I write that down?
Yeah, that's a great point.
Like, I'm not even telling my parents that. Like now I just told my parents because I just said on the podcast and I'm all the way grown and
you're
still
all the way grown right now. Yeah, I know I don't have you forever, but I want you to touch on a couple of things. I don't know how much time we got left.
I have time.
Okay. So critical race theory. I told you I've been doing my research, right? For the interview. Cause I know what you tweet and post, but I wanted to do the deep dive, read the fine print. So critical race theory, feminist legal theory. Is that your focus, your writing focuses, your focus, the stuff that you write about a lot, right? In personhood and stuff like that. Do you think critical race theory and feminist legal theory is at odds?
Whoa, that's a hard one. So I think critical race theory and white feminism is at odds because white feminism is always at odds with intersectionality. If feminist legal theory is what it's supposed to be, like to me, I hate to say I'm intersecting critical race theory and feminist legal theory because feminist legal theory should incorporate critical race, critical, ableism and disability, like it should be a big tent. And the problem is what we end up is with is white feminism. One of my friends is always like the white women's committee when she talks about stuff. Yeah, she's right. Like, it's the white women's committee, then it's the actual feminism committee, right? Mm-hmm. And so the problem with feminist legal theory is that so many people are not intersectional and it becomes the white women's committee, which is what happens with all feminism, which is why you have so many black women who will say, I'm not a feminist, instead of being like, no, I'm a real feminist. They're not really focused on true equality. So, you know, what I think is interesting is I consider myself a business law scholar.
Okay.
And the reason I don't think, you know, I kind of push back on saying I'm a critical race theorist because I think everything, which then is going to echo what critical race theory is. Every system in America is racist.
Mm. Sound so, like an Africana study major right there. Okay, go ahead. Talk your shit.
So if I am doing business writing, if I am writing about corporate law, I'm doing critical race theory if I'm doing it right. Because I'm acknowledging the reality of the racism of the entire system of American commerce. All of American commerce is built on slavery. Banking, and finance, property ownership, housing. I'm teaching this module. I'm teaching a UCC class this semester, and I'm developing a module based on the 1619 Project with some additional readings. And what I've done is had our campus historian, what is her official name? She's an anthropologist, and she is our director of institutional history.
Okay.
I had her go through and pull records of when the university owned and sold slaves and what they did with the money. And I have developed a module for the students where we're going to analyze the transactions using articles 2, 3, 4, and 9 of the UCC to show the difference between classifying a person as a person and a person as property. So, you know, these slaves are collateral for loans. These slaves are bought and sold. The proceeds, you know, these slaves are leased out the way you would lease out animals. Like you can't lease a person now, right? Mm-hmm. But these are people being leased the same way you lease cattle. Mm-hmm. So that the legacy of that classification and the fact that banking, insurance, and all these industries, all these commercial standards come out of what do you do when someone has pledged a slave as collateral and they sell them? That's Article 9. Mm. That's the foundation of Article 9, right? That like, what do we do when people sell the slaves that they pledge for collateral? What do we do when, you know, someone beats their slave that they pledge for collateral and that slave dies.
That like, slave dies, yeah. I think we had a sound like that in law school. I remember a case or something like that.
So like, how do you possibly talk about freedom of contract and enterprise and even business entities? Corporations owned Black people, right? If corporations owned Black people and were declared legal persons 200 years ago, what does that mean for our relationship to corporations today? Right? Many of our, right? You know, like, or even like I was looking today at a promissory note that was given to Robert E. Lee by a railroad during the war because he leased out some of his slaves to help fund the war effort, and he leased out the slaves to help construct the railroad. So it's like, wait, during the Civil War, we have a corporation that is a railroad that probably has a successor today that started all the way back then, that leased Robert E. Lee's slaves and funded the Civil War, right? And it's the Northern International Railroad. And we try to say there's no race in business law. All of business law is race.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to bring you back. I don't know if you want to come back to talk business law, because I looked at one of your, I looked at a couple of your things that you have on YouTube, and then I share it to the people too, that you were breaking stuff down. Because you sound a lot like you said, you can either pay me now, or you're gonna pay me much more later. You can pay me now, you can pay me later, but it's gonna cost you a lot later. I forgot the exact quote, but I say that all the time too. Like as a business lawyer, like, you're gonna pay me now, you're gonna pay me later. Choose one.
I'm indifferent as long as I get my money. Right.
As long as you got the money, we could do it either way. But I taught the class I taught at Rutgers, it was my class that I created, but it was in the undergrad department, in the Africana Studies department, actually. But it talked about, I didn't notice about you until just now, but the class I taught was discussing how, like, so it was undergrad, so you gotta be walking through it, but not, I'm not necessarily the person that's gonna like hold your hand and act like you can't step up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So the class was basically like trying to answer the question, like, you know, somebody might say my family came from Jamaica, Russia, whatever, nothing in their pocket, and they quote unquote made it. It's like, what happened to Black people? So the class was like the critical thinking about like what happened to Black people when you're not even a citizen, you're a slave, right? And your property, and then like going to, it wasn't too, I guess I stopped at 2016. Like, so what does separate but equal mean commercially? Like, we know what it means, you know, socially, but what does it mean like for business? Like, what does redlining mean when most people, you know, a lot of people get their wealth through their homes, and they can take loans out. Like, what does the GI Bill, all that type of stuff. So it's interesting that I'm glad you're out there doing that type of work.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I think it's important. And I think, you know, it's unfortunate that people can't see the racist underpinnings. Like, I had a fight at a conference once with somebody who told me that I was misreading race into something, because race didn't exist in the context we view it today with what they were researching. And it was like from the 1600s. And I was like,
damn. Yeah, he's
so
wild.
So Columbus came here in 1492, and the first slave was an American in 1619. Well, you know, yeah. Well, we didn't think about, I was like, no, you were inventing race at that time. That's when whiteness was invented.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people don't know that either. See, yeah, you go, you're using the Africana study degree. I see that.
Like, y'all were inventing whiteness to justify your behavior at this time. So if you're going to be a historian and not talk about how whiteness is invented with the transactions you're discussing, and why like the transactions don't work unless you invent some whiteness, then your scholarship's just not it, right? It's not thorough. Like, you're missing a story.
Absolutely.
If you're not talking about the invention of whiteness.
Yeah. So I gotta get you back, because it's multiple things I wanna dig deep. If you wanna come back, I ain't gonna deep.
I can come back. Yeah. You know, we just sitting at the house. What are we doing? It's COVID.
Yeah, right. last question, at least for today.
Okay.
The ADOS movement. You've been following it? You've been following it? What's been going on with it?
Ish, a little bit. Okay. It upsets me. But go ahead, ask your question.
I was going to ask you, what do you think about it? How do you feel about it? However you want to answer, what do you think about it? How do you feel about it? What is the pros, the cons?
Before we started with whiteness, we started a discussion of whiteness, and it's good that we have already discussed what it means to be the gatekeeper and do the master's work. Because I think what is happening is as America gets to be more diverse, some Black folks are about to become white. Because that's the only way white has been dominant, right? And so while it seems like it is American-born descendants of slaves, however they want to classify it, trying to carve out for themselves and be special, what you're essentially doing is giving some whiteness or some intermediate status to everyone else, such that, like, you know, this is how census changes start, right? You know, like suddenly Middle Eastern people are white on the census. I don't know if you paid attention.
Nah, I'm paying attention.
Middle Eastern people are white now on the census this year. And it's like, oh, y'all need some more white people. Mm-hmm. Right? What's going to happen when we stop saying Hispanic white or Hispanic Black and we just say Hispanic on the census? Or we start just saying Caribbean instead of white, Black? Like, what happens when we stop parsing it and it's Black and everybody else again? Which, and it's like, we are contributing to that. Like, we don't understand that we are a tool, you know, of master.
I gotta start adding you on some of these things. I try my best to limit my Facebook posts, my Facebook interaction to 30 minutes a day. I'm failing horribly in the last month. But I gotta start, because they be getting at me, calling me coon. And I'm like, you realize your response to white supremacy is rooted in white supremacy. How do you figure? Then I'm like,
you know, though, not everybody can be helped, which is why I don't wade into that.
Yeah.
Like, when Wakanda starts, we gotta leave some people behind. And so I'll take some of those as you're not gonna get the barcode to get into Wakanda. That's how gotcha. I take some of it. Right. So it's like, yeah. Like, some white folks might get in and you might not. Like,
yeah,
so,
that's true.
So I use it as my, like, who's on the Wakanda list, some of these discussions. Gotcha. Yeah. And if somebody goes too deep into the misogyny and too deep into, like, you know, the super pro American Black crazy, I'm like, you know what?
Yeah, they're not going to make it.
Because that's basically Kanye. What happens next is you're a Republican, right? You start there, and then some Black women hurt your feelings, and then you're a Republican. That's the evolution of that.
Yeah, we got to talk about the
hurt hour on Black Republicans and Kanye.
Yeah, we got to talk about that. If you want to come back, we got to talk about, because
I keep saying I'm going to write a post tenure paper on that.
Yeah,
because I don't know who would publish it. Yeah. But I have a whole theory on, like, what makes a Black man a Republican.
Gotcha. And I have my theories too. We can share.
It's all rooted in a Black woman hurting your feelings at some point.
You think so?
Absolutely. And it could be your mother. It could be that your mother hurt your feelings.
Yeah, that's something we don't talk about. Like, I think as a people, we talk about, you know, Black dads, Black men not being shit, but we don't talk about, like, the scars that your mother could have left you with. And how does that
affect? I have been known to tell some Black Republicans they don't love their mama. So,
yeah.
In a really, really heated conversation when I'm on like 20, not 12.
So. I can see that, though.
Usually with some liquor. You know, I don't tell people they don't love their mama when I'm sober.
Yeah, I actually can see. I mean, I didn't think about it until you planted the seed, but I could see how that could be a thing, that you just don't like, you know, women, or a woman hurts you and you're just mad at the world. I could see it.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, when we think about Black people and we think about who are drivers of Black culture, you know, it's always like Black girl magic, this, this, this. And so if you don't love Black women, it's really hard to love Blackness.
Got you. That's the part. Hard. Yeah. So we can end it on that. So tell people where they can find, because I can't come behind that statement. So say that last statement again.
If you don't love black, it's hard to love Blackness if you don't love Black women.
Got you. And give people where they can find you at, whatever you want them to find you and whatever.
Easiest to find, you know, I'm at Carlis C. So my first name, last initial on everything, Instagram, Twitter. I have a website that I haven't updated because COVID, but I will. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I make all my posts public because I don't care. It's all public. It's like, yeah. You know, I don't say anything to anybody I wouldn't say to their face on social media.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I know you're supposed to end it, but it's funny because I've been hit behind the scenes by many of people from, you know, classmates, lawyers, people I grew up with, like, yo, you should make your stuff public. I'm like, why? Like, it is what it is. Like, I don't.
People who know me are not surprised. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, right, right. They were like, oh, yeah. I'm not going to even tell that story because she'll figure out who I'm talking about. But yeah, I've been hit behind the scenes many a time. Like, yeah, you should think about making your stuff private. And I said, for what? Like, one, first of all, there's no such thing as private. I don't, people just got to get over that. And it's like, I am who I am. Like, and I'm not above apologizing or changing my opinion. But at that moment, I was trolling. I try not to troll, but when I do troll, I usually have like some type of message to it. Some type of educational point, but it's framed in a way that's going to get attention. Or, you know, I feel like this, I might turn it up a little bit just to make it hit better. But for the most part, it is what it
sometimes
is.
I'm just being petty. Like,
exactly, right?
You just caught me on the wrong day.
You just caught me on the wrong day. And our social media persona shouldn't be clean and all that. Sometimes you just catch me on a bad day and I just said the wrong thing. And it's,
yeah. And I'm a Gemini, so I don't really apologize. so you're better than me.
I haven't apologized in a long time. So
I'm like, I'm sorry you're offended. That's how I apologize. Yeah.
Got you.
That's a Gemini apology.
Got you. All right. So thanks again. And as always, if you like this show, you're going to please like, rate, review, and please go follow Carlos Chatman. This CARLISS. CHATMAN. I got it right. Right. Yeah.
That's right.
And she's a professor. She is entertaining. She's smart. Last question. When is the book coming?
So what's crazy is there are three books now.
Okay.
So two of them are case books. One is a children's book.
Okay.
I'm writing a children's book on corporate personhood called Companies Are People Too. And my illustrator is supposed to be done with the graphics by end of this month, if not end of next month. So I'm hoping to drop the children's book January of 2021, which, you know, buy it for all your kids, all your friends' kids, buy it for that adult that don't read good, right? Okay. Like, buy it for everybody. Then the case books, one case book we're hoping for fall 2021. Okay. And that's with the business associations, you know, basic intro class case book. And then the other case book is called Documenting the Deal. And it's going to be an M&A casebook that's going to walk through. We're going to annotate mergers and acquisition documents, and including all of the ancillary documents, and explain what all the different parts are. And so that's for use in like an M&A class or a skills class. We're shooting for 2022 for that one.
That sounds expensive, that book.
Yeah, so that was going to be good. I think practitioners will actually buy that one.
Yeah, that sounds like when you was describing it, I'm like, that might be a book that I might even pick up.
Yeah. I'll get some comp copies. I'll, you know.
Got you. Yeah. And just a suggestion. I think you could take it or leave it. I think you should work on like a
general audience book.
General audience books. Like, I'm a big fan of all.
So that's actually the plan for the spring, is getting a book together.
I mean, I know we only got 24 hours in a day, but I think you have something to say. I think you say it in a very entertaining, educational, intelligent way. I'm thinking like, I don't know what style it would be in, but I'm a really big fan of Malcolm Gladwell right now. Mm-hmm. Like, if you can, like, the race and the feminism, the corporate, somehow some like Malcolm Gladwell ish, and you bring in the examples and driving it home. That's what I'm thinking. But you don't got to follow.
It's interesting what you say that. No, but the book I'm thinking of actually writing first is a general audience, although it may be with an academic press, is my persons versus property comparison. So the stuff I'm doing with 1619, you know, walking through the different aspects of personhood, being property, and just like, you know, putting that story together in a way that's approachable and all in one place. Because we've got the banking and slavery scholarship, and we've got the income inequality scholarship, but no one's done the personhood aspect of all that. So that is the book proposal I'm planning to work on in the spring. I say just proposal because if I tell myself I'm going to write a book in the spring while writing those other three books.
Right. Yeah, finish the other three books. Get your money up. Finish that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think like I said, that's just a suggestion, putting it out there in the universe.
No, you're not the first person to tell me that. And what's crazy is I've already talked to some presses about it. I just got to sit down and I've got to leave in the spring. So when I'm not teaching, because I do still have to teach the children, you know.
Gotcha. Gotcha. All right. Well, thanks again. Are you coming back? We're going to get on the record. Are you coming back?
Just let me know. Just let me know.
All right, cool.
We sitting at the house. We ain't doing nothing.
Got you. All right. Let me stop recording right now. All right.
All right.